Chapter 16. The Vanishing Mermaids. Parnell Winston worked as Hartson Brandt described his experience.
"There really isn't much to it," Mr. Brandt said. "I started out for Whiteside in the fast boat."
Winston focused a flashlight into one eye, then the other.
"I was on the north side of North Cove when the boat smashed into something. I was thrown violently into the water."
Winston tested the scientist's reflexes, using a finger instead of the traditional rubber hammer.
"Apparently I was badly shaken up, because my memory becomes unclear at that point. And when I came to enough to recognize my surroundings, I was in a strange room. It turned out to be the cabin of the houseboat."
"Do you remember any strange sensations or smells?" Winston asked.
Rick listened, heart pounding.
"None. The people on the houseboat were most considerate. One of the men insisted that I get into some of his spare clothes, and I did so. One of the women, the wife of the man who came here, I believe, made me a cup of hot consommé. They told me I was apparently whole, with no broken bones."
"Yeah, I guess they were helpful and pleasant," Rick admitted. The houseboaters had done just the right things, including coming to Spindrift for help rather than bringing the scientist home in the slow-moving and rather uncomfortable pram. Instead, Hartson Brandt had waited on the houseboat while one of the men brought the pram to the island with a request that someone follow him back in a more comfortable boat. Rick and Scotty had done so, and they were almost limp with relief at finding the scientist apparently unhurt and comfortable.
"How does your head feel?"
Parnell Winston demanded.
"Rather stuffy," the scientist admitted. "I'm finding it difficult to collect my thoughts, Parnell. Why all these questions?"
The cyberneticist rubbed his bushy eyebrows with both hands, a habit he had when agitated.
"Hartson, as you know, I'm nay a doctor of medicine. However, I do claim competence as a physiologist, and consequently, bodily reactions are familiar to me. I believe you've been drugged."
"Drugged?"
Rick's heart stopped momentarily.
"Yes, I've looked for the mark of a hypodermic needle, but there is none. If I'm correct, the drug was a light one, probably amitol. Your reflexes are slower than normal, even taking the accident and subsequent shock into account. And your pupils react slowly."
Rick came to a sudden decision. He went to the desk and picked up the phone.
"What are you doing?" Hartson Brandt demanded.
"I'm calling Steve Ames. We need help now." In a few minutes, Rick had the agent on the wire and was giving him the details of the accident over the scrambler system. He concluded,
"If Dad was drugged by the houseboaters, like Dr. Winston thinks, that means the enemies now have his brain pattern."
Steve Ames asked,
"Is Winston there?"
"Yes."
"Ask him a question for me. Would the brain waves be considered quasi-optical?"
Steve meant, would the waves be of such high frequency they would act like light? Rick put the question to Winston.
"Tell Steve the answer is a qualified yes."
Rick repeated the information.
"All right, then. We can assume that the brain scrambler, or whatever you call it, can operate only from short distances, approximately to the horizon. Tell your father he has to get out of town. He's got to pack his bags, then deliver him to the New York Yannick office. We'll take it from there. You got it?"
Rick had it.
"How do I make sure we're not followed?"
"That's a tough one. Air travel would be surest. Do you have any landing lights on Spindrift?"
"No.
Besides, it's a short runway, and only a pilot who knew the island could possibly land at night."
"I've got a pilot who knows it, so forget going to New York. Rig lights of some kind. You could put lights on the roof of the lab building, I'm sure. Then put a pair of lights at each side of the runway's end, so he'll know how far he could go. If you have nothing else, soak newspapers in gasoline. He'll buzz the island. That'll be your signal to light up."
"Is Mike Malone the pilot?"
"Malone had landed there before."
"Yeah, he'll take over. He'll deliver your father intact."
"If we can," Rick said slowly.
"Steve, suppose the enemy activates their machine when they hear the plane. Suppose they suspect he's getting away and turn on their mind reader."
"We're going to have to chance that. The best thing is to move fast. Get your father in with Mike. Let them clear out. Then tell Mike to put distance between him and you as fast as he can.
All right, Steve. There seemed to be no other way. Rick turned to his father and Winston and repeated the conversation.
He's right, Hartson, Winston said. You're in good enough shape to travel. Better get packed.
The cyberneticist looked at Rick.
What did you call the enemy gadget?
A mind reader. That's an odd name.
I didn't think about it, Rick told him. The name just popped into my mind. But doesn't the enemy machine read the patterns in people's minds and then erase them?
I guess this is as good a name as any, Winston agreed.
Well, let's tell the others.
Then you have work to do getting ready for the plane, Rick.
Mrs. Brandt, after making sure her husband was no more than slightly dazed, had been forced to turn her attention to Barbie and Jan. The two girls were on the verge of sheer hysteria with fear for their fathers. Scotty had joined Mrs. Brandt in an effort to soothe the girls' frayed nerves. Now, as Rick opened the library door, he could see that the two pretty young faces were tear-streaked, but as calm as could be expected under the circumstances. Scotty looked worn out. Rick could only marvel at his mother. She could always be relied upon in a crisis. Mrs. Brandt listened to her son's report and then nodded firmly.
Steve is wise to insist this, Rick. I'll help your father pack.
Rick beckoned to Scotty. We have work to do. Let's start with the lab. On the way, he filled Scotty in on the details of what had happened in the library. Then he asked,
How did you get the girls to calm down?
Scotty shook his head wearily.
Wasn't fun. Poor kids are scared stiff. Remember, they haven't been exposed to stuff like we have. To them, our stories are just exciting fun because we leave out the horrible parts. Now they're getting a taste of this business the way it really is.
Did you tell them that?
Well, that and a thousand other things. Nothing much good. And Mom couldn't make any headway either. Another 10 minutes of tears and the island would have been underwater, honest. Finally, I got rough. I told them that we were in this all together. They were only creating a nuisance that complicated things and didn't help at all. Then Mom chimed in. You know how she does. Never raises her voice. She said real courage consisted of being terribly frightened, but trying to remain calm in spite of that. Then she said she was rapidly becoming ashamed of both of them. That did it. They stuck their chins in the air, wiped off the tears, and actually managed to smile.
Well, good for them, Rick exclaimed.
Inside the laboratory, they went at once to the stockroom. Floodlights were stored there, among other items. Extension cords were plentiful, and there were electrical outlets on the roof. In a few moments, the boys had strung the lights, and Rick had readjusted the board downstairs so that all the lights were on a single circuit. That way, they could all be switched on or off at once. Joe Blake came to watch. Rick explained what he was doing and told Joe of Steve's conversation.
I know, Joe said. Steve called me on the radio. He didn't want us shooting Mike down for trying to land without warning. But how come you can cut the circuits in and out like this?
We never know when an experiment will call for electric power in some unexpected place, Rick explained. The main board is set up so that we can do just about anything we need to. We can feed normal current in or 440 volts. We can cross-link the circuits any way we like. Scotty checked Rick's work, then took the switch handle. He touched the contacts briefly, and there was a quick pulse of light as the roof lit up and went dark again.
I'll stand by here, Scotty said. You stand by at the end of the runway. You going to use gasoline?
We're going to have to. It would take a long time to run power from the house and hook up lighting units. Gasoline will be quicker and easier. Let's go.
There was a supply of gasoline for the boats. Rick got a 5-gallon can while Scotty collected newspapers. Two trash cans served as containers. The cans were filled with newspapers, then drenched in gasoline and placed at the last possible point the runway could be used. If Mike overshot the containers, he would land in the sea. Rick worried about the problem of lighting the containers without getting burned. Then he went to the workshop and selected rags. He twisted the rags loosely and tied them together and poured gasoline into a bucket and soaked his rag fuse. The last step was to insert one end of the fuse in each can. When the time came, he would be between the cans, and then he would light the center of the rag string. The fire would travel rapidly because of the gasoline. In case Mike was delayed in any great period,
Rick kept the gasoline handy. He might have to wet down the cans and fuse again. He had forgotten to ask where Mike would come from, and Steve hadn't volunteered. Probably he would come from Washington, which meant an hour's flying time in the plane that Mike would use, a fast little four-place job that Rick had long coveted. But Mike wouldn't be ready for takeoff instantly. Time had to be allowed for Steve to give him instructions to get from wherever he was to the airport, and then to get the plane gassed up and ready. Allow another hour. That meant 2 hours at all. Inside, Rick was still scared. How did they know the electronic mind reader couldn't be activated at any moment? He hurried into the house and went upstairs to where his father was packing. He couldn't do anything, and he knew it, but it helped just being near the scientist. Apparently Scotty felt the same. He had joined Hartz and Brandt, too, but Barbie, Jan, and Mrs. Brandt had preceded him. The scientist smiled. "I've never had so much help packing before." The smile was strained, and Rick thought he knew why. He hadn't seen his father face great physical danger without losing a bit of his composure. But the insidious weapon that could read all reason out of minds was far more horrible to a man like Hartz and Brandt than any physical danger could be. Bullets, knives, clubs, they would leave bad wounds. They might even kill. But what chance was there for anyone with a damaged brain? Scotty looked at his watch and held it up for Rick to see. Nearly an hour and 3/4 had passed since the call to Steve. Rick gestured to Scotty and urged, "Hurry, Dad." "I'm ready." The scientist closed his bag. Barbie got to it first and lugged it down the stairs, refusing Scotty's offer to help. The boys went to their stations while the others waited on the porch. Rick checked to make sure he had matches, then worried because a wind had sprung up. Suppose it blew his match out. He was about to go borrow his father's lighter when he heard the far-off drone of a plane. Well, there wasn't time now. He held the matches in his hand ready. The drone grew nearer, rising to a whine. Then the plane was diving. Suddenly it was overhead and gone with a crash of sound. Rick saw its lights head out to sea. Mike was making a tight turn to come in for a landing. Rick's lips formed the words, "Now, Scotty, now." As though he had heard, Scotty threw the switch. Lights flared on the rooftop, outlining it clearly. Rick struck a match and held it to the saturated cord of rags. Flaming gasoline ran along the cord in both directions and then up the sides of the cans. There was a loud whoosh of exploding gasoline, and both cans were ablaze. Rick ran away from the heat. Mike came in low and fast over the lab roof and slapped the plane down on the turf. In a moment, he applied the brakes, and the wheels whined their protest as they dug up the grass. Then the plane was rolling to a stop directly in front of the house. The pilot jumped out and called, "Hey, gang! Come on, sir, no time to waste!" Hartz and Brandt kissed Mrs. Brandt and the girls, found time to pat Rick's shoulder, and climbed in. Rick took the suitcase from Barbie and handed it to the scientist. Door closed, and the plane was whirling, catching them in its prop blast. Mike taxied back fast to the laboratory, turned the plane, and revved up, holding on the brakes. Rick saw Scotty emerge from the lab building and go right back in again as the prop wash caught him. Then the plane was rolling and lifting. Mike skimmed low over the burning trash cans and banked out to sea. In a moment, he was gone. Rick felt a sob rising in his throat and resolutely squelched it. He walked to the burning cans and dropped covers on them. Scotty cut the lights on the lab building. Had they made it? They wouldn't know. Not until Steve reported that the scientist was safe. On the porch, Barbie asked,
"How soon will we know?"
Rick was proud of her. Her voice trembled only slightly. "Probably not until tomorrow, sis. Come on, let's all hike off to bed. It's been a rough evening."
"All right. Rick, we still don't know for sure, do we, about those people in the houseboat?"
"We don't know for sure, but we have a pretty good idea. How else would Dad get drugged?"
"Mightn't they have just given him a sedative?"
Jan asked.
"That would have had the same effect."
Rick hadn't thought of that. He admitted it was possible.
I wish that radio trick had worked,
Barbie said sadly.
I wish we had some way of getting a radio on the houseboat. Then we could listen in on everything they said.
We've got no way of doing that, Rick said. He was very tired. Forget it for now. Let's all just turn in. We could talk some more in the morning. Steve Ames phoned at 5 o'clock in the morning. Rick had been sleeping lightly, his rest broken by nightmares that he couldn't remember when he awoke. He got to the phone in the hall. Just a minute. Let me get downstairs to the switch. The entire family was close on his heels as he went into the library. He threw the scrambler switch and then asked anxiously, Yes, Steve?
I just got word, Rick, so I called in spite of the hour. Your father is safe inside the compound at Los Alamos. He's all right, and just as a precaution, he'll spend most of his time in a shielded area where no radio signals can penetrate. Now go back to bed and get some sleep.
Rick thanked him gratefully. Los Alamos? That was one of the two main atomic energy weapons laboratories. No place in the United States was more closely guarded. Well, now he could be sure his father was safe as anybody could be. He repeated the conversation to his anxious family. Now, he said, echoing Steve's advice, let's go back to bed. Perhaps we can really sleep for a change. And he did sleep. It was nearly noon before he awoke. He got up sleepily and found Scotty had just barely preceded him and was now taking a shower. Downstairs, things were apparently normal. Mrs. Brandt and Mrs. Morrison were at work on lunch. But since an hour was too long to wait, Rick had a bowl of cereal and a glass of milk. He was careful not to choose crummies. Scotty settled for 3 donuts and milk. Where are the girls? Rick asked. Are they still asleep?
They've gone swimming, Mrs. Morrison said. They should be back soon, though. They've been gone for over an hour.
I could use a swim myself, Rick admitted.
Not me, Scotty said. Wait until afternoon and I'll join you. That cold water would shock me into a state of galloping goose pimples the way I feel now.
Rick had forgotten just how cold the water was.
Yeah, we'll wait. Let's go over to the lab and take down the lights. I want to clean up those trash cans, too.
They walked leisurely over to the laboratory and stopped for a moment to chat with Joe Blake. Then, before starting on the lights, they walked around behind the lab building. Laboratories were built on a promontory that sloped inland toward Pirates Field, which was just above sea level. The raised area ran around the seaward side of the island, so that the Brandt house was on high land, too. On the north side, the land sloped down toward the boat landing. Rick stood on the edge of the low cliff and looked for Barbie and Jan. They weren't in sight.
They must be using the lungs, Scotty said. Look for bubbles.
No bubbles were visible either. Rick checked carefully and began to worry. It was a calm day with little wave action, and the bubbles from the aqua lungs should have been clearly visible. Surely they wouldn't swim so far out the bubbles couldn't be seen on a day like this.
Let's check, Rick said.
The boys hurried to the room where the scuba equipment was kept. 2 of the aqua lungs and the blue and white equipment were gone. So was the cart. A quick look at Pirate's Cove showed no cart in sight.
Where could they have gone?
The boys hurried to the front of the lab building again and found Joe Blake still getting a bit of sunshine.
Joe, have you seen the girls? Rick asked hurriedly.
He nodded. He motioned across the island.
They came and got aqua lungs and hauled the cart across to the north side. They were probably swimming over there.
Rick doubted it. He doubted it very much. The currents on the north side kept the bottom stirred up, and visibility was usually too poor for diving. Without the need of exchanging a word, Rick and Scotty were suddenly running. As they passed the house, Rick had a sudden thought. He went in and ran up the stairs to his room. He grabbed his radio unit and turned it on.
Barbie, he called frantically. Barbie!
There was no answer. Tucking the unit into his pocket, he ran out and joined Scotty again. If Barbie had her set, she wasn't using it. Come on. He led the way to the boat cove and stopped short. The speedboat was there. So was the scuba cart. But the rowboat wasn't. Anxiously, he scanned the water. There was no sign of the girls. Where were they? Where could they have gone? And then he remembered Barbie's comment from the night before about bugging the houseboat. Had they gone to the houseboat?